Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we discover the untold stories, for art's sake and for your sake.
Our guest today is Dikshina Tarakia-Pering. Dikshina leads the engagement and skills team at Somerset House in London. Throughout her career, Dikshina's focus has always been on learning and engaging young people. Prior to joining Somerset House, she worked as part of the learning and engagement team at the London Transport Museum and the Science Museum Group.
Dikshina's interest in engaging young audiences is particularly relevant today when many museums struggle to reach them. She has a wealth of knowledge and experience to share, and we can't wait to hear how to engage younger people in museums and art spaces. Dikshina, a very warm welcome.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me.
No, thank you for joining.
Before we delve into the world of your professional work, we'd love to learn a little bit more about you as a person. So can you tell us what led you to work in museums? What sort of inspired you to get involved in the sector in the first place?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of fell into it. That's the line I always use. It wasn't some predetermined goal when I was like 10 that, you know, I want to be head of engagement and skills at Somerset House. And also, as my career started, I think I had ambitions and goals, and they've really changed and evolved because of the experiences I've had. And my advice to anyone out there is don't decide what you want to do in 10 years in a set in stone kind of way. Otherwise, you're going to shut off a lot of other corridors and avenues. Yeah, I grew up in central London. I grew up in northwest London, in Camden, had museums and galleries on my doorstep. Didn't really go to them, though. I went on school trips, kind of British Museum and places like that. That was kind of cool. But there was a really significant moment in my childhood of a museum experience. And it's the one I still go back to. I was 10 years old and I went on a sleepover to the Science Museum. It was my best friend Hannah G's 10th birthday. Hannah G, because there was like five Hannahs in my primary school class, but only one Dikshina. Yeah, Hannah G's 10th birthday. We went, it was like kind of Science Museum had just started doing sleepovers at the Science Museum as well. So it was a new thing. And we slept in sleeping bags in the Space Gallery under rockets. We went into the interactive galleries like after they closed and got to play and like stuff. We made astronaut ice cream. We ate terrible food. And it was amazing. It was brilliant. There was five of us that went with Hannah for her birthday. And we had an explainer looking after us called Brad. And in this picture that I have that always sits on my desk wherever I work, it's me and Hannah G and all the other girls and Brad. And we've made a pyramid out of marshmallows and straw. And I remember it all like it was yesterday. And it was the most amazing experience. And when I came home, because I have a good Indian mother, I had a maths tutor and she was like, your maths tutor's nearly here, but tell me how the sleepover was. I was like, oh, it was great. It was brilliant. When I grow up, I want to be an explainer. And she was like, what is that? And I was trying to explain what an explainer was. And she was like, that's nice. Let's focus on doctor, accountant, lawyer, you know, the regular stuff. If in a movie, that would be a montage, a flash forward, and I would have become an explainer, as I did do. But that's not how life really went. I forgot about that experience and then carried on through school thinking about those very traditional routes and then messed up my A-levels in a really bad way. I was meant to study law because I was following the good Indian route and kind of panicked. But my mum was very lovely and supportive, and we went through clearing, and I loved history and I'd done it for A level, and I actually really did want to study history. I just couldn't get it to fly with my mum, really. So yeah, I ended up studying history at university. And when I went to university, I went to University of Aberdeen in Scotland. They asked you to study other subjects. So I picked up art history as well. And that is when I really started to see about careers in the museum and gallery sector. I didn't really know about curators. I didn't even know what that word was when I was 18 years old. And through that, I decided to do a joint honours degree in history and art history, did some internships at the Wallace Collection, volunteered at the British Museum, places like that. Thought I wanted to be a curator, but very quickly learned that being a curator meant a lot of reading and writing. I'm dyslexic and I'm okay at it. I'm good at it, but it takes a lot of effort to be good at it. But what I do love doing, as you might have noticed, is talking. And I learned at an internship at the Wallace Collection that there was this education team and their job was to like think about the interpretation and how you make it accessible and talk a lot. So I decided that's kind of what I wanted to do. And then I did a master's at the Institute of Education in Museum and Gallery Education, which gave me a lot of theory, but my real practice and my real values and like how I think about my career came when I started working. And I should end that little anecdote with my first job was in a museum, paid job, was an explainer at the Science Museum. Oh. So yeah, it's a lovely roundabout story. The Hollywood film of it would tell it very differently and make it much more exciting. But yeah, that's kind of a bit about me, I guess, and my career into museums and galleries.
So all of that's now led you to working at Somerset House. For anyone who is listening and might not be 100% familiar with what Somerset House is, could you tell us more about it? What's it known for? Is it a place you'd visited a lot before you started working there?
Yeah, so Somerset House is London's working arts centre. That's how we talk about ourselves. People will know us for the Christmas tree and the ice rink at Christmas, but we also do films and gigs. We have a really varied multimedia style cultural programme. We also have exhibitions and events on site as well. But what people don't know about us is that we have over 400 creatives that, I was going to say live and work, just work, they don't live there, work at Somerset House. I kind of just love that idea of what how it's an art centre, but it's like breathing and living and working. And that's so exciting and makes our collaborations and our the feeling of the building really exciting as well. I was aware of it. I went past it quite a lot growing up, like on my bus. My school was in central London, so I went past it quite a lot. But I do have a really key memory from it. When I was at university, actually, towards the end of my degree, I really got into this artist called Rob Ryan, who's like a design illustrator and does a lot of paper cutouts. They have had an exhibition where Rob Ryan moved his design studio to Somerset House, and you could go and like see him and his, you know, team like working and stuff. And I went along with my mum and my aunt at the time, and there was a gift shop at the end, and I bought a tile from there, one of his tiles that he created, which had one of his kind of cutout prints printed onto it. And I bought it, and my mum was like, "Why are you buying a tile?" And I was like, "Oh, well, you know, it's quite cool that, like, you know, you can buy a piece of, it's a piece of art, but it cost me like 10 quid. Like, it's really cool." And my mum said, "Okay, well, where are you going to put a tile?" I was like, "Oh, one day I'll have my own house and it'll go in like my son's room or something, or my daughter's room." And it sits in my son's room now, which is, it's just really nice. But I just love that accessibility. Like, it was a kind of popular culture. It's about like, it was about something right then. It wasn't so much about looking at the past or the history. It was something there and you could really engage with. You saw artists working, you could buy something not very expensive, take it home. And I just loved it. And after that, I did go to films and gigs with friends, but I never saw it as a place I was going to work. It's not like it was, you know, in the nicest way, anyone from Somerset House listening, no offense, it wasn't like a dream place to work, but I don't think I fully understood what Somerset House was. But yeah, like as my career's gone on, I've watched it, and that creative community, that collaboration that comes, and how you create content and programming and events, just because of all of those different people and bits to it, makes it such an exciting space to work in.
Wow, so interesting. You currently lead the engagement and skills team at Somerset House. Engagement is a term which seems to mean something slightly different at a lot of different institutions. What does it mean for your team at Somerset House? And what does your role entail?
I joined Somerset House in January 2020, and I became the head at the time of learning and skills. But I also joined at a time as the world went into a pandemic. So what a year to become the head of engagement skills. But so when I joined, learning implies to me, and this everyone has lots of different thoughts on this, but learning implies a schools program, a very formal, traditional way. And to the public, if they hear learning, they think of school, they think of academia. And that is right. Some organizations, they have family programs, schools programs, you know, really varied programs. But for me, what I saw at Somerset House was this, that real exciting community that I mentioned, that the idea about kind of developing talent and emerging creatives and young people coming through that. Our content very much focuses on the now and the future. It's contemporary, doesn't always necessarily link to naturally to a schools program. So I kind of, what I thought we were really doing is engaging people, exciting, making them excited about things. And I just wanted to move away from that very traditional word that, you know, that's learning, that's loaded for people. Like, if you're a young person that's had a difficult academic journey, then do you want to be part of something that's called learning and skills? Because you're thinking, well, is it going to be like school? But would you want to be something, part of something that's called engagement in schools? Well, that's kind of like you're thinking of entertainment and engagement. And the skills bit is really important in, you know, that will never change, because it's all about whether you're creating a workshop for a family audience coming in to engage with an exhibition. What you want them to go away with is a great experience, a great engagement, but you also want them to go away with a skill or a idea or a thought. And it's the same for a family audience as it is for a young producers program that we created. It's the idea is we want them to have a great time, a great experience, engage with us, be part of us, but we also want them to have the skills they need to live happy and successful lives.
That sounds like a really fascinating transformation of that department and what it means to you, not just the people working in that department, but the visitors, the public as well. As part of that transformation, you touched on a couple of projects there, like the Young Producers Program. What are some projects you're working on right now?
We had really great ambitions when I joined in January 2020. We had an exhibition of summer of 2020 called No Comply, which was all about skateboarding.
I was excited about that.
You'll be happy to know it's coming back this summer.
Sweet.
So it will still happen. But alongside that, we were going to launch our first Young Producers Programme and two co-productions. So we were going to work with a group of 12 young people to design the flag that flies above Somerset House, which always links to an exhibition that's happening on site, and also create a film with one of our resident film artists to respond to the themes of the exhibition. And it was going to be shown. We have, over the summer, we have 2 weeks of films being shown in our courtyard. And before the kind of film started, we were going to have a little preview of our young producers film. So it was going to have massive reach. And it was so exciting, an exciting way to really launch a young producers program with authentic projects that are actually part of our cultural program. They're not sitting over here on the side. They're like center and core. But the pandemic hit, and naturally, like everyone, we were working out how to work online, let alone taking everything digital. So we paused those projects, and we, like every other organization, thought about our digital program. And there was lots of things that we were doing. And we kind of just paused ourselves. But there was one part of our program. We used to do these kind of sessions called the Creative Job Studio, which we would invite creatives in and young people in to come, and the creatives would talk about their creative journey and then to kind of do a networking and a Q&A, and they were great. But we thought we could take that online, but how do we take that online and also kind of have reach but make them work, and, you know, just give young people access to something when loads of young people, especially 16 upwards, were really struggling. Like, their exams were gonna, you know, not happen. Like, their, you know, what did the future hold, like qualification wise, experience wise and stuff. So we worked with one of our creative career industry placements. So we've been running a program for 3 years called the Creative Careers Academy, where we have five placements that we recruit and induct, and they do placements within our creative community, and then we train, evolve and develop them. And her name was Hodan, and she said, well, that's a really great idea, but it needs a better name, Creative Job Studio, or, you know, like, how does it connect to the internet and stuff? So she came up with the name Upgrade Yourself, and we launched our Upgrade Yourself program, which was monthly sessions linking to creatives in our creative community, talking about their creative practice, and then a live Q&A. Our on-site sessions, and across a year, we reached about 800 young people. Our online sessions from April 2020 to December 2020 reached over 80,000. So it was a success that we didn't expect. And there was something in that. So there was definitely a market for young people looking for opportunities. Then we got to June, the murder of George Floyd happened. We thought about, like every cultural organization, our response to that. We made a statement and we decided to write a pledge of commitments that we were going to make. And as that was happening, I was thinking, well, this really connects to the work of a department like engagement and skills, like about diversifying workforces, making authentic experiences, exploring our history. And we knew we were going to recruit historians to come and explore our history. But I thought, wouldn't it be great to also have a group of young producers that come in and they explore our history, like six young, you know, representative Londoners exploring that and creating something. And that's our first project, which is actually going to launch in 2 weeks' time on March the 16th. It's called Decentralized. It's six young Black creatives and our first six young producers. And they have explored our history as Somerset House and what we are, but also how we have shown and displayed Black art and culture in our history as well. And it's this archive, it's a design website, so you can go on, there's artists that have inspired it, you can pick artworks and create your own artwork, save them, and it's absolutely brilliant. So do check that out. And then our second set of six young producers are working with another artist collective called Superflux, and that'll be launching around Earth Day later in April. It's going to be an online exhibition. And it's called Hope in the Heat, and it's looking at young people's thoughts about the future and, you know, with the climate emergency and what that means. And it's really exciting. And what I love about both those projects is you have one project which is looking at our history and our past as an organization and like thinking about representation. And then you have a second project which is looking at our future and, you know, what does that mean for young people in the world? And it's really exciting first two projects. And like I mentioned, the No Comply ones, they're coming back. So hopefully this summer we'll be doing the flag design and the film and with the exhibition. And what I love about all of that is the Decentralized project links to a value of Somerset House about anti-racism. The Superflux project, Hope in the Heat, links to a really important issue of our time. And then the No Comply project links to our cultural program in a really specific way. It's showing how you can run programs like this wherever you are in such different ways and link it in so many different ways.
And I absolutely love the name Decentralized. It's so interesting that the term became, I think, central actually to so many fields recently. So you mentioned the pandemic, obviously. So what lessons have you and your team learned during the pandemic? Are there any changes you've made which you'll be carrying once things are back to normal?
you know, just getting your head around so much a year ago around what lockdown means, how are you going to work, working digitally. I think there's some well-being practices that have come out of the way we work. So, you know, we can not always have to be on site, but there's something about if you work in a museum or gallery or heritage site, it's about your site. So you kind of need to be there to be inspired and connect. So, but still finding a balance to make that work. I think there's things around thinking about how we deal with change and make decisions. The pandemic removed kind of systemic structures that we had to like have things signed off in such specific ways to make things happen. But the pandemic showed that you don't. You can make decisions and be responsive for your staff, for your public, whoever you need. And we really shouldn't lose that because that's made some really exciting programming and kind of things accelerate. And the word I use is I had a plan when I joined Somerset House around engagement and skills. And I thought it would take me 3 or 4 years to establish that plan. But the pandemic in many ways has accelerated this focusing of young people for us as a team and an organization. And that's beautiful. And when I think about the work that we're doing and the year that we've had, there have been times where it's felt not in control, like it's felt in flux, not always getting it right, but then going, okay, that didn't work. Why didn't that work? Let's try it again, and accepting that. And that's just been really, I can say it now in hindsight, it wasn't always great at the time, but it's been a really nice journey to be on and kind of reflect on how that's changed how we work day to day. And that's really important.
No, thank you for that, Dixon. I think that's a really fascinating response. And I think you actually absolutely touched on something really, really valuable there. A lot of people have just taken to working from home and it's like, hey, I get to work from home. But for those of us who do work in heritage sites or in museums, that space is kind of one of the perks of the job in a way. I work at a heritage site and I haven't been on site for most of the time I've been working there. And you lose a little bit of something. So it would be nice to get back to that.
Yeah.
In addition to your work at Somerset House, you're also a trustee of the Museums Association. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm in my final year of my final term, so not for much longer, but yeah.
As part of your trusteeship with the Museums Association, you've been involved with the Museums Association manifesto. For those who might be unfamiliar with that manifesto, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. So the Museums Association launched its Learning and Engagement Manifesto in November of 2020, but there had been 2 years worth of work before that. So I was a board member since 2016. My background, as you've learned through this podcast, is about learning and engagement. And I think the Museums Association was making real headway to think about, you know, not just curators, but thinking about front of house and all the different departments that make a museum. And I think they were doing some good work around learning engagement, but it kind of felt like a part of the sector that just hadn't really been talked about or researched or explored in a really long time. And for me, it was since David Anderson's A Commonwealth, like which I studied on my master's course, which I'm sure you both did as well. And I should say, when I joined the board, David Anderson was on the board. So that was quite a fangirl, weird moment. Anyway, back to the manifesto. So I kind of just approached it with Sharon Hill, the director of the Museums Association, and said, you know, I feel like there's something that MA can do, like to really look at this and research it. So we actually met with David Anderson because of that being the last big significant moment. We thought about where we were. So that was 2017, 2018 when we started that. And we were looking at where the world was at the time, where the sector was, what was happening. And we decided we needed to kind of find out how people in this part of the sector and work and learning and engagement felt about their careers, about their work they did, as well as wider departments, and look across all the nations on that, because it's very different in whichever nation you're in. We started off by conducting some roundtables, collated all of that. And, you know, what really became evident was just a bit of lack of love for people in that part of the sector. Their work relies heavily on funding. A lot of them feel like it sits over here. It's not, I'm trying to show you, it's a podcast, I can't show you that. Sits to the side. It's not center or core. And, you know, there are some really small places doing brilliant work. There's some really big places that need to do better work. So, you know, it was really mixed, like what came out of it. And what I said was, you know, I really felt like what we needed was not another paper or, you know, a lot of detailed research. You kind of needed like a call to action, and that learning and engagement is not, it can be driven and led by a department, but it is not the sole responsibility of people that work in learning and engagement programs or departments. And we all agreed on that. So that's where this idea of like a manifesto, like a call to action came about, and keeping things really simple and clear. And if you look at it, that's how you'll see it. It's like clear points, got some case studies attached if you want examples, but it's not making you read like a lot about it. And yeah, and then we just ran lots of sessions beyond that where once we started writing it to test it. So we invited different groups. I think overall across the 2 year period, we spoke and heard from, I think it's over 500 people from the sector before it, you know, was finally ready to be launched. And I think it's like, you know, one of the proudest things I'll probably ever do, because it's not just about me, or it's not one of just about my organization. It's to support the whole sector. And that's a lovely thing to have been part of. And it's been really well received. And that kind of decentralizing, if to use the word of my young producers, like to kind of make it centralized, if that makes sense, was become really, really important. So that it's everyone's thing. And the anecdote I always say is when you apply for a job at a museum, whatever department you apply for, you will be asked like, why this museum? Why this? What object do you like? You know, things like that. But how many of us in how many departments are asked about engaging or audiences, or what's your role in making sure our public have a good connection to our work? And it is always in our learning and engagement teams or our front of house teams where we're asked those questions. But actually everyone across any department at the interview should be asked about the museum, the collection, and also engagement, because it's all our jobs to think about that.
And we'd love to learn a little bit more about this connection between learning and production. So you've mentioned a few times the word producers, production, and also in a recent Museum Association's article, which is, I think, quite recent, in 2021, in March 2021, you mentioned that in the near future, museums will be working more with media partners and in a way more sort of like Netflix, but for cultural content. And this also means that some jobs in museums will change and become similar to a producer role. So could you give us a little bit more insight into how this is shaping up and where this idea comes from?
Yeah, I think I've always thought about it for a while, because I think we kind of, museums and galleries don't always necessarily connect ourselves to the wider creative and cultural sector as much as we can. And we're a stronger force as a creative and cultural sector rather than being our independent mediums or bodies that we need to be in, that joint up approach. And I thought about it for a while. And you know, what you're doing, especially in a learning or engagement team, you are producing content, whether it's a workshop or a resource or, you know, whatever it is, you're producing content. And the job titles we have in the sector around learning engagement are always like officer or, you know, administrator or coordinator. Yeah. Lots of coordinators out there. And they vary. What does that mean? A coordinator at a national museum is so different to a coordinator in a small museum where they're basically managing everything, you know, like, and I thought about this, and I thought about my own job titles as well. And I just feel like it is a producer role. And that's become even more evident in the last year through the pandemic. And I think about that on twofold. There's the digital side of it, because there's going to be a real importance for us all, regardless of our departments, having digital skills. When the pandemic hit, everyone looked to the learning departments, engagement departments, and they looked to the social media team, who all of a sudden they realized did more than just write tweets. And it was all about digital in that way. And that's got to continue. And you're right, the job roles will change over time. But already you're seeing it. I'm seeing it in national organizations through restructures where they're changing those learning department roles to producer roles, because that is what they're doing. It also means we'll have more transferable skills and we can move between creative and cultural sector roles in an easier way, which means hopefully there might be someone who, whoever ran the BBC's online learning, bite-sized learning during the pandemic, is phenomenal. And their production skills are needed in the museum and gallery sector, but they probably might never have thought of themselves doing that. In the same way, our work around engaging people in around collections and like sites could definitely support a company like the BBC. And that brings me to the idea of digital strategies. And what I love about Somerset House is our new head of digital, Eleanor. She talks about our digital strategy as a broadcast strategy, because it's how you're broadcasting your content or your ideas or your thoughts and connecting with audiences. And what I love about Somerset House is we think in a bigger way than just about the mediums that we deliver things. And we think about how we connect to the creative industries. And I think that's such an important thing as we move forward.
We've talked a lot about the professional side of things and the professional side of things with regard to the pandemic as well. But if we can just touch on the personal a little bit, something that a lot of museum professionals face, one of the biggest challenges is parenthood. How do you find juggling your professional and your personal workloads, you know, being a pandemic parent? Today's, I think we're recording this on probably the last day of homeschooling for a lot of people. So how's it been?
Well, I'm absolutely terrible at balancing it, I should start out with. But I think that's okay. And the reason I say that's okay is not because I'm saying it. I read Michelle Obama's autobiography in 2019 as I started a new role at the time for Somerset House. And she said, there is no way to balance it, but you need to find a way to feel comfortable with what you're doing. And there's no, you know, I could look to someone else and go, you're doing it like that, that's how I should do it, but that's not going to work. And, you know, if Michelle Obama says she can't find a way to balance it, then I think we all just need to accept that there is no way to balance it. What I would say is that the pandemic has led to like this, it's not working from home, it's living at work. It bleeds, like everything bleeds into one another. And it's really hard. And I've definitely just stayed on my emails longer than I should have at the end of the day, just to wrap stuff up because I don't have to commute. I've definitely started earlier because I don't have to commute. But actually what I'm doing is bringing back parameters and controls for myself. And I'm doing it in a really visual way, actually. I'm putting it into my calendar, like Dictionary out the office because I'm going for a walk, but I'm writing that in, you know, like. And also I used to find it interesting when before I became a parent, people would put in like, you know, childcare or pickup or whatever. And I used to think, like, I don't know, it just made it sound like it wasn't about a person. But I always put in my son's called Seth, so I always put Seth drop off, Seth pick up, because it's a person that I'm going to pick up or drop off, and he's a really important person. Like, no offense to the director of Somerset House, he's more important than you, so like he is going to have a priority in it. But what I should say is that I've worked in a number of places, and the reason I feel empowered to be this way is because currently at Somerset House, there's a really lovely culture of well-being, and it's coming from the top down. They're displaying it and I'm displaying it, so my team see it. And I'd say to anyone out there, like, if you're feeling like you're not doing it, think why you're not doing it. Are you not doing it because you don't want to, or you feel nervous? And I have worked in places where I felt like I couldn't fully be a parent because it was seen as like slacking, you know. And I've been in places where I've been 100% supported for it as well. And I think it's so important that if you have any kind of role where you can influence or lead, that you need to display it and give ownership and power so someone else can. How they then do it, it really is up to us as individuals to do it. You can't really blame anyone. It's really weird. You think, however many years, I think I'm 15 years, 14 years into my career, you think these are such obvious things, Dictionary, but as you try and progress and build, you get bad habits and you kind of have to unlearn them. And I think that was actually Michelle Obama said that, not me, so let's give her the credit. Hopefully that answers your question.
You mentioned you are sort of 14-15 years into your career now. Do you have any advice for younger museum professionals looking to start their career that perhaps you wish you'd received? Or conversely, on the other side of the coin, do you have any advice for established museum professionals looking to bring in a young voice into their work?
I think, weirdly, I was just writing a talk to do somewhere, and it was about key moments in my career. And the thing I really stands out to me is when I was given opportunity or a chance to do something, even when I wasn't clearly like completely ready or right. So my advice is to ask to do something if there's something you want to get experience in or what you want to do. But also for anyone in a kind of managerial position, don't just look for the person that's going to do it perfectly. Like, look for the person that it could really benefit and, you know, support them in their next steps. I think I said at the start of this, don't narrow down your career. So I at one point would have thought I want to be like becoming a manager or a head of department was like the ultimate. But the head of a learning program that was solely like very traditional in my head at the time, like a school's program, a family's program, like all of this work that I've completely love around young people, around workforce, around wider mediums beyond museums and galleries and, you know, cultural production. Just didn't even know it was a thing when I was started working. And I think I took a few risks and took a few jobs to get those experiences. So when you're looking for those jobs, look broadly, look widely. And if you see a job and you think, well, I can't do it, firstly, those people saying that are going to be women, you can do it, so just apply. But what I do is look at the skills asked and the experience asked and think, well, I have these things, but I don't have this thing. And then I kind of set myself a goal to, do I need to go on a training course? Do I need, you know, do something to get that experience so I can talk about it and identify so that when that job comes up that you really want, you can hit all of it and you feel really comfortable and confident going into it. And finally, I think you just really look at the values of the organization that you're applying for. I've talked briefly, I've touched upon like working in places where, you know, I've really not been able to be myself or feel supported. And when I applied at Somerset House in my interviews, I asked about the culture. And now you're going to say, oh, well, they'll just say, they'll just tell you what you want to hear. It's a lovely culture. We all take 5-hour lunch breaks and get paid bonuses every year or whatever. But you can get a real sense, you know, in an interview, like keep asking those questions, do some research, see if you can find people that work there, ask them what it's like, because you're going to spend more time at work than at home. So you should really love it. And I think I can remember the second part. My mama brain has not failed me here. The second part was what should we, people that want to bring in younger voices or young people into the organization. So young people's programs always sit in a learning engagement kind of department. There's nothing wrong with that, but that will always kind of make it sit to the side, or if you don't center it and make it core. And the way I think about it is any young kind of person's program you're bringing, or development, like training, talent development, whatever you want to call it. If you're creating that program, if you create it from the core of your organization and think about everything across your organization, like where can their voices be? Where can the opportunities be? Where is their training and development? And you build it in, then actually those things will affect the wider HR practices of that organization. An example there is recruitment around young people's programs is really open, welcoming, and supportive. So there's probably lots we can just take from our young people's program and implement into our main recruitment practices to make them kind of more accessible to people. It's just one example. And the model I always go to on this is it's Paul Hamlin Foundation have a model called the asset-based framework, which is all about thinking about young people's voices from the core and how you build it. And they have a beautiful visual diagram that helps you map it out. And so, yeah, my idea is you don't have to do everything straight up. You can just focus in on one or two things, but think about how it can have impact and influence across the organization. So yeah, that would probably help people thinking about building in those programs.
Amazing. Thank you. I think that's really, really solid advice for both of those groups. We have a couple of questions we ask everyone at the end of every episode.
The first one is more an invitation to imagine, or rather reimagine, some aspects of museum work. If you had unlimited funding, what museum or cultural space would you build before or after COVID?
Oh, wow. What a question. What I think a lot about, because I think about young people's programs, that's what my passion is for. I think about how, you know, youth centers, local authority budget cuts, you know, young people, we want them to come into our museums, our galleries, we want them to feel like part of it. And this whole concept of youth centers and what does that mean? And I don't think you need like a community center or youth center. Imagine if you had a museum or a gallery and you had the place where the young people hung out and opportunities and, you know, job support and mental health support and food and drink was like this dedicated space. So like not your normal learning space that you use for your events. They design it, they curate it. It's got tech, it's got equipment, but they're already in your space and they're hanging out. So then you can actually say, oh, let's connect, let's work together, let's do that. And imagine if every museum or gallery just had that. You know, you could be local and have one in your local area, the bigger organizations that they could have them. And there's something about that. It would support a pretty big issue, which is about young people not having spaces to go to or ownership. It would also address the issue about getting in younger audiences and making them feel like it's their space and they should have a voice and be part of it, but doing it in a really natural and organic way. And yeah, so it's not really something I would build, but build in every museum or gallery across every nation, which is probably far too ambitious, but yeah.
No, I think that's really fair. And I think that sounds like something that there is definitely need for in a lot of institutions.
Yeah.
Just one last question. If there's one thing that you want people to go away from this interview thinking about, what is it?
One is it's a good time to look at what's important to you, like your values and, you know, in your work and your personal life, and just to check that against where the world is right now and what your job is, and just sense check that. I think that the pandemic has created this way that, you know, it might be the time to move on to something else, or to ask for something at work, or to create a change that just makes sure that you're living your most happy and successful lives.
Amazing. Thank you, Dikshana, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I've never felt so professional with a microphone. So thank you.
Where can people find you?
Twitter is my best one, at DT Perring. Feel free to follow me. And on there, that's where I do all my kind of work and signposting. You will find me on Instagram. It's a closed account. It's closed for a reason, guys. So don't go adding me on Instagram.
Thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you very much, guys.
hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of For Art's Sake. If you'd like to learn more about who we are and what we do, find us online at forartsake.co.uk, on Twitter at @sake_arts, or on Instagram at forartsake.uk.